present. Representatives Blumenauer and Ragsdale will be briefly delayed. I don't know where everyone else is. Today, committee will begin work on the landlord-tenant bills. I know a large number of people signed up to testify, and it's my intent to go no longer than 3 o'clock on the landlord-tenant bills, and therefore I'm going to suggest that insofar as humanly possible, limit your remarks to about 3 to 5 minutes, if you can condense it. This committee has a number of bills to deal with after 3 o'clock, work session on House bills that are still very much before us, and we need to get them over to the Senate. We intend to hold at least one more hearing on this bill, maybe more. Okay, so don't feel like you have to let out all the stops today. First, I'd like to call on Senator Keith Burns. Senate Bill 159.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Senator Keith Burns, the chairman of the Senate Committee on Local Government Urban Affairs, and we considered Senate Bill 159. We worked very hard on it. Took a great deal of time and the energy of our committee to get this bill out across the floor of the Senate. There were many changes made in it from its original version when it came to us. As you know, this bill originated from the Uniform Commission on State Laws. Mr. James Clark is here, who is a very able Portland attorney who serves as a volunteer member of that national body, and he described the bill to us in its original form. We frankly found that we're talking about a little different situation in Portland, Oregon than we are in Los Angeles, Chicago, New York, other such places, and felt some of the procedures in Senate Bill 159 are somewhat cumbersome for our uses and perhaps not necessary. We got down the path quite a ways until we started getting some constructive input from some of the landlord interests, and they did sit down and we worked out amendments, compromises, and so forth. Some of them went further than I personally wanted, but I think the bill, on balance, is a good bill. I would be very disappointed if it got weakened much more. I think it's fair to both landlords and tenants. We have very little law now that protects tenants. This bill gives them substantial rights, and I think the bill, if you go through it section by section, I'm sure you will, you'll find that they provide many more rights to tenants than they have in the present time. I want to say that Mr. Hunsinger, who is the administrative assistant to our committee, would be available to you at any time. The clerk of our committee, Mary McClure, would provide copies of any of the testimony in certain sections if you find you'd like to have that, and that would be available to you at any time. There's one section in there that I think is important to explain our approach to it, and that's where it awards attorney fees to prevailing parties. That section's in there with the hope that attorneys won't be involved at all. And it's there to try to discourage parties from going into the district court with their attorneys, but rather to take their claims into small claims court. As you know, small claims courts have jurisdiction of $500. What happens today, and I'm not talking about landlord-tenant, but generally, when a party goes into a small claims court and say the person who wants to go in on a small amount, but is not going to have an attorney, can't afford an attorney, and he's suing somebody that has economic advantage, a financial advantage, and can afford an attorney, maybe has one retained, then the trick is always to say, well, just go in and say you want to have a trial by jury. And under the Constitution of the State of Oregon, it involves more than $20, you're entitled to a trial by jury. So So that pulls the thing up to the district court. So say a person's going in after a $30 security deposit. Well, if we didn't have prevailing attorney's fees there, and there are no attorney's fees provided for, then he's going to throw in the towel, forget about his $30 deposit. But if he's sure he's entitled to that $30, he'll go to an attorney and explain it to him. That attorney agrees. The attorney will say, fine, I'll take the case and let the other side pay the fee because we're going to win. And so it will discourage landlords from taking that out of the small claims court to begin with. And if the tenant does have a meritorious case and they do take it out of the small claims court, why, then he's going to be able to get an attorney to represent him. But hopefully it will discourage these cases from going up in district courts at all. And so I want you to understand that. That's important. We gave up one thing in here that a lot of people are going to think very important. That's a repair and deduct, where a landlord doesn't repair the facility and they would go and repair them and deduct the rent. Frankly, the people who were counting the heads on the floor didn't think we could pass the bill with that in there. So we threw in the towel on that. I don't think you have to have that to consider that you've got a very strong piece of legislation. I think it's strong now. If you get a pass the floor with that in there, that's well and good. But those are just some of my general observations on it. I'd be happy to answer any questions. I want you to know that our staff is available to you at any time.
Senator Morris.
There's a philosophy that's expressed in this particular bill, and I'd like to get your thoughts on it. One of the first times I run across it is in Section 9, which deals with prohibited provisions in rental agreements. And part of the phraseology speaks, if a landlord deliberately uses a rental agreement containing provisions known by him to be prohibited and attempts to enforce such provisions, the tenant may recover, in addition to his actual damages, an amount up to 3 months' periodic rent. Several times in this bill, there is that provision where the tenant can go against the landlord and recover not only the damages, but 2-3 times the rent. What is the philosophy behind this?
Well, this is a lot of, there's a lot more of that in the bill. We eliminated that in many instances. This is not a unique thing in law. We find it where it's provided where people cut timber and get treble damages, double the amount. It's felt in rather aggravated cases. I believe why this is here is where the landlord will present an agreement to the tenant and having language in there that's prohibited by law, and the tenant would sign it. And then the landlord would use it saying, you agreed to this, and the tenant not being aware of the law that was prohibited. Because that was an unconscionable conduct on the part of the landlord to do that, and wanted to do everything we could to prevent them from incorporating such language in an agreement for a person to sign it. Because we think of tenants that they're going to be threatened by it, and they aren't going to go to an attorney, and it's just to discourage that from happening in the first place.
Well, then on the landlord side, the only point where he could collect damage. Other than, of course, the court case, would be his security deposit, for example, for lack of payment or damages. I'm trying to look at both sides of this, and I see the tenant's getting awarded monetary damages. Do we have any?
There's a couple of sections in there where they can, there's a couple of sections in there that does give extra damages to the landlord. I believe where there's damage to the willful damage to the property, as I recall in that section, my recollection, Representative Morris, that there was some in there, and I.
Well, I've been through it once.
My recollection is there's one or more instances where such damages are available there, but the Well, here's one example. In section 30, subsection 3 of line 21, page 17, if the tenant remains in possession without the landlord's consent, the landlord may also recover not more than 2 months periodic rent. There is a lot of language like that in here, but insofar as the instance you brought up, it's if this passes, then the representatives that are going to be here representing landlord interest testifying here, they're going to have attorneys redrawing all of these agreements to make sure there isn't any language like that in them. And that's the kind of thing we'd like to see happen.
Keith, I have one question. Section 21 seems to be arousing a good deal of controversy in the procedure by which the money is paid into court. Could you walk us through what this section would actually provide?
What page, John?
Page 13 of the bill, section 21. I think the concern here is for the small landlord.
Where he's not going to be able to pay, make the monthly payments and so forth. We heard that inside, we heard it on the floor as well.
As the bill stands now, what would the process be? Could you give us a typical situation and walk us through it, how it might work?
Well, as it is now, when he counterclaims for something and says that in the event the court from time to time may order the tenant to pay in court all or part of the rent accrued and thereafter accruing, this is while he's still in possession, remaining in possession, and it's to cover the situation where he's counterclaimed and he, for instance, he's had to pay out money for fuel or various other things, and it's in litigation and the court hasn't determined the rights of the party, but the court at any time when it feels that it has sufficient money there to cover the counterclaim, then the money could be paid out from time to time to the landlord. Now, it may be that more sophisticated language could be drafted to handle this to protect them, but I don't know when you get into areas of this type, it seems to me, and I know some people feel the same way as I do, that it's important to leave a lot of discretion to the court to handle this type of situation, otherwise you get so much language, such a technical procedure. A good example of that was when we tried to work out, we were talking about attorney's fees, prevailing attorney's fees, to have try to set up some kind of an arbitration system. So they wouldn't go into court at all, and how you're going to have this funded. And we looked at some Washington legislation, and we went through several things like this, and it just seemed to add so many pages of the bill, it was so complicated, we thought maybe the best thing to do is just try to discourage people from leaving small claims court in the first place. But it's just, how important you think that is in the bill, and how sophisticated you want to, language you want to use to point out the procedure. This leaves a lot to the court.
How have courts been acting in similar, or is there any kind of similar situation that they might be acting?
Defenses on the part of the tenant. Burns had it for you. I'd just like to generally say a couple, three things and then leave you to further deliberations and hearings that you have scheduled. In 1970, the U.S. Census reported that 36% of Oregonians live in rental units. And more than 80% of those rented for $149 or less, 35% for $99 a month or less. Of course, we could expect that these rentals would be marginally higher now, but the figures do suggest that the extent and the economics of the field to be covered by any landlord-tenant statute. I would suggest two clear goals for any such measure: that it be simple, and that its thrust be towards the maximum degree of self-enforcement, and second, that it have at its heart the principle of reciprocal rights and responsibilities. A statute that will merely encourage litigation and dispute and expose half-informed tenants to possible court costs due to evidentiary findings may only promote bitterness, where the real aim should be remedy. On the other hand, we will never get rid of bad landlords unless we set some general standards to which he is responsible and provide some enforceable remedies. Everyone is aware that there are landlords who will double talk, be unavailable except when the rent is due or overdue, who will shirk, dodge, duck, and evade, and generally conduct themselves in an unbusinesslike manner. In any other enterprise, they would soon run themselves out of business. A fair but specific set of statutes governing the landlord-tenant relationship can drive out the bad landlords. An unbalanced measure based upon the assumption of class warfare without end or reason to it can serve to discourage the good landlords, causing him to give up and despair. As a result, taken in sizable numbers, which can only mean a general lowering of the standards, especially in lower rent housing, that would leave the field to the bad landlords, the lawyers, and the courts. It is appropriate that we be concerned about the landlord abuses in the field, but it is important that any legislative action bring a general disappearance of these abuses and hopefully a decline in the number of bad tenants. It is all a two-way street. The landlord and the tenant each need each other. Ideally, the law should provide a bill of rights for the tenant while offering constitutional protections for the landlord. The committee will have ample opportunity, to study all the landlord-tenant legislation in detail. I will reserve specific comments on this legislation until later hearings, Mr. Chairman, and that will be my statement today.
Any questions of Representative Aikson? She's listed later on the sign-up sheet, and at that time you might read it to us. Kent Whitaker.
Sections we think are the most important to us in the industry, and hope to give you some examples of what I'm talking about. For example, areas such as what's abandonment. I think in one section they defined it as 15 days, but in other areas it wasn't. What's unreasonably withholding or unlawfully holding access? it's material noncompliance. Terms like these that tend to be going throughout the bill bother us a little bit, and it quite frankly makes it difficult when you read this kind of a bill to advise your client, because you're not really sure always in any situation what is material noncompliance or what is not performance necessarily, unless it's spelled out more specifically either in the statute or in the rental agreement. Section 12 is of some concern under security clauses. And it's not that the landlord is opposed to security clauses, but one area that troubles them is it defines it as the primary function to secure the performance of a rental agreement. And we're not exactly sure what is meant by performance. For example, if a landlord is renting a home on a year lease, and he provides that there will be payment of the first and last month's rent, usually the last month's rent is in the form of a security deposit. If the tenant decides not to pay, say, the fifth and sixth month, does this mean now that he hasn't performed the contract in breach because this was security for the last month's payment, therefore you can bring an FED proceeding? Or are you to apply this on the 6 months rent if he hasn't paid and then hope that he'll pay the 7th month? It's this kind of thing that we think ought to be spelled out a little bit more. And this would tie in with subsection 4 under section 2, under subparagraph 4, section 2, which says that the deposit can be maintained by the landlord to remedy tenant's default. Well, if it's spelled out more specifically, not only is it a benefit to the landlord, but tenant as well. Both are better able to understand if there's been a default. So we think that the performance ought to be spelled out. Also, would this type of definition preclude taking a deposit normally labeled as cleaning, but with the idea that it'll never be refunded? For example, some owners will take a $50 deposit and tell the tenant that he is to have $25 refunded if he leaves the premises clean. And the other $25 is used for maintenance work, such as painting, touch-up work that's necessary to maintain the premises. Would this kind of language preclude that altogether, because this would be considered performance, and if he's cleaned the rental, then he can't have it refunded? Or would it come from the other section where it's used as a payment or a deposit, which might include an advance payment of rent, to secure the execution of the rental payment? I don't read it that way. I read that as a security to hold the rental for the prospective tenant. So we think it needs to be broadened a little bit and defined more specifically. Section 14 deals with the landlord maintaining fit premises. We have no quarrel with this provision generally. We only have one item that of some concern, and that is there's a provision that there must be an adequate number of appropriate receptacles for garbage and rubbish, and that the landlord shall provide and maintain appropriate serviceable receptacles and arrange for their removal. Well, this is probably practical in the apartment unit complex, but we don't think so in the single family home. We think that the individual renting a house should provide his own service and pay his own bills. We think it's too cumbersome and too expensive to have to provide for that. And I think most homes do it that way now anyway. All I'm saying about this language is it tends to preclude that kind of arrangement of agreement if the parties want to enter into it. Under section 17, one thing we are suggesting is deleting the terminology unreasonably withhold consent to a landlord to enter the dwelling and change it to the read that a tenant shall not withhold consent to the landlord. Under subsection 3,
Mr. Chairman, can I ask a question really long?
Sure.
Obviously, you have something in mind, specific circumstances or conditions where you're asking to have unreasonably changed.
Well, we're going to tie it into the next portion dealing with the 24-hour notice. I think we'll tie it in some way. And also, in some situations it's just not practical to unreasonably withhold it. So there is another vague term for just saying don't withhold access. There is a provision later on that says that there must be a 24-hour notice given in case, except in case of emergency. And so probably in most situations you would have to do that anyway.
You think a 24-hour notice is sufficient? We don't need unreasonable.
Well, that's our opinion.
Senator Morris.
I'm going to ask questions to go on. I'd like to very briefly get back and ask two quick ones. On page 6, section 12, your confusion then is on the terminology of performance of the rental agreement and execution of the rental agreement.
Right.
Okay. Okay. On page 9 of section 14, subparagraph I, I'd like to get your thoughts. Talking about ventilation, ventilating, air conditioning, and other facilities and appliances. What about the concept of requiring screening in all doors and doors and windows for ventilation?
I mean, what? You know,
what's your comment?
Comment as being in reference to screening.
Could you identify yourself for the work?
My name is William Foster. Remember the Port Home Builders? Family Council. Speaking as for the Home Builders Association. Ventilation, air conditioning, and appliances, elevators, maintenance should be kept in good repair. Normally, all new purchasing, all new building, screens do come with windows. There's no problem with that. You should have screens. But that's just something that comes automatically. There are screens that are damaged. That are need repair, some are blown off, take care, should be replaced. There's no concern about screening.
Go back and work with some of the older units and try to screen.
Back to the older units. It's quite a cost factor for putting new screens onto an older building. They have to depend really if it merited or not. So I would just say that they have to determine on the condition of the building, tenant selection.
May I ask a question?
What was the objection to the
17
on access? Same section 17, third line 8 on page 11, you get into the 24-hour notice requirement to see the premises. We don't think this in and of itself is an unreasonable piece of legislation, except that we think that this provision should not apply if the tenant has given his 30 days notice to quit. Then we think that the landlord should have the right to show the premises at any reasonable time. And this is because a lot of times there is drive-by traffic for tenants who see an apartment available, come up, they want to rent, and maybe the type of rental they would have in mind might be presently occupied. And in order to show it to this, it would be necessary to give a 24-hour notice. And if the tenant isn't very patient and drives down the street and sees what else he likes somewhere else that is available, we'll take it. So we don't think that it should apply if there's a 30-day notice to quit given by the tenant, or of course in the case of emergency, but in other situations it's suitable and it will present no problem at all. It's a fair request.
Do you think that the 24-hour notice stipulated here on page 11 is very unfair?
No, we don't think the 24-hour notice is unfair. We only think that it ought to be modified so that if the tenant has given a 30-day notice to quit, then you shouldn't have to get a 24-hour notice. You should be able to show it at any reasonable time to a prospective tenant. But oftentimes it may not be vacancy. Under section 19, non-compliance by the landlord, there's some language that there's a breach. the notice given writing by the tenant, the landlord has 14 days to remedy this. I think the 14 days is too short, should be extended to 45. The reason it's not always easy to get the right subcontractor or to get competitive bids within this period of time. And if you impose that short a time, it might necessitate either the work may not get done or maybe done improperly. And this can be an expensive item to the landlord because it's very expensive to maintain the premises anyway. And if there's constantly the demand to keep it at a high maintenance level, and if there isn't the right type of work around to do it, it would be very difficult to get done. So although a breach should be remedied, you think 14 days is too short, I suggest 45.
Going along with that theory, assuming the tenant moves out, you feel the new tenant should have any knowledge or any be provided with any reasons why the old tenant moved out? What I'm thinking is that if there's a deficiency and the tenant brings it to the attention of the landlord fails to make the necessary repairs inside of 14 days, the tenant moves out. All right? The new tenant moves in, the deficiency is still there, and many times the landlord could be used in the same excuse over and over again.
No, I don't think the landlord's ability is the same excuse. If you're renting the apartment, presumably in a defective condition, the condition should be corrected.
I'm in agreement that it should be, but.
Yeah, well, I mean, it should be before the new tenant comes in, or he should be aware of where the condition is, so he's not saddled with that. Moves out later. I think to that extent, yes, he should be either advised of it or it should be remedied. It takes over. But we're talking oftentimes about a tenant that probably may be a good tenant, and if he's assured that this problem will be taken care of, and the reason for the delay, oftentimes he'll smooth over the problem and he'll remain there.
The comment that I have in reference to that is that every new tenant that didn't come into one of my units, we have a checkout list, or a checklist. There's 108 items on the checklist. If we're proficient, my manager is proficient, can run through in 3 or 4 minutes with prospecting tenant. Any default, any problems are indicated on our checklist and assigned by the president to come in tenant in. And then, of course, it's taken over to our maintenance crew. Our maintenance team takes care of it, or to the manager to remedy our problem. And if it isn't taken care of, when the tenant moves out, that's still on the list, the manager's in trouble. You've got to keep enough first cabin type operation.
Is this common with all people who rent property?
With all people?
Well, is this a common practice in the industry?
It's getting to be a common practice. Yes, this is what we're teaching. We're trying to strive to make a uniform system. Better for the tenant, the landlord.
I've been a tenant since I was 21 years old, and I haven't seen it yet. I know you're trying. Any further questions?
Section 21 has been discussed, but as I read this provision, it provides that the tenant can still remain in possession if you bring an FED or suing for non-payment rent, or both, presumably, if he has not paid his rent. And then, of course, the provisions for paying into the court if there's a counterclaim. What do you think that this language, as it's written, is very unfair to the landlord? We think that he ought to be able to have the right to still bring his FED proceeding and regain possession. If he wants to bring a separate action for rent, he can. And the tenant should have the right, if he wants, to file his counterclaim for any breaches. and then whatever mechanics, and I'm not sure what the procedures would be, could be followed through in terms of the payment of either the rent or the payment into the court for the breach, if the court determines that there's some amounts due and owing. But to allow the tenant to remain on the premises until this is ultimately decided, maybe a matter of several months, we think is an unreasonable burden. We think that the tenant should have to give up possession if an FED is brought, and that still give him the rights to bring his action on a counterclaim or a separate action if he wants to for any breach of the agreement. We think this is very fair for both parties, rather than allowing him to remain there for an indefinite period of time until this can be remedied. Particularly if the court finally decides that there isn't any rent due, the landlord may have lost several months' rent waiting to find out what's going to happen. Because it doesn't really spell out any procedure for bringing this into court immediately. The present system is if you sue for rent, you wait. You can put it on the trial docket and wait until your time for trial comes up. If you're in Multnomah County, you may wait 6 or 8 months. So unless there's some procedure spelled out, the man remains on the premises, and there's no special proceeding to determine that rent or damages from breach of agreement due until the end of the waiting period, until your trial date is set. So we think that allowing the landlord to regain possession immediately should not be denied to him. Like bring a separate action for rent to once.
Any other
Section 23 is of great concern to us.
Could you pick up the pace a little bit,
of course? Provides on line 20 that rent's unpaid when due, the tenant fails to pay rent 10 days after written notice by the landlord of non-payment. In other words, if we read this, he has to give a 10-day notice every time that rent is not paid when due, which would do away with the automatic 10-day grace period. And oftentimes, even good tenants won't pay on the first day if rent's due on the first day, but they may pay the second or third day because of whatever the payday falls due. And so the landlord can be on his toes to assure that the tenant won't remain there any longer if he is in default. He's going to have to, first day by midnight or some appropriate time, be depositing in the mails every month notices to every tenant who hasn't paid the first day, whether he's good or bad, saying you're now in default, you have 10 more days. And if he waits 5 or 6 or 7 days, then the landlord remains another 10 days. Remains another 10 days. So we think that this ought to be deleted and that the automatic 10-day provision remain. There ought to be no written notice required. The tenant hasn't paid when due. He has a 10-day grace period. If he's not paid by the end of that period, he's in default. Section 26 of landlord liens, we feel, as present form, should be deleted entirely. We feel that his landlord liens should be retained. We think this is the only form of security the landlord has for his payment. It has psychological impacts upon the tenant if he knows he may lose his personal property. And even the IRS has the right to go in and close down your business without a judgment if you haven't paid your taxes. So we feel that the liens should remain.
Representative Morris.
You said lien should be maintained. Where did you take it out?
Section 26.
Okay.
I'll make one more comment. Section 31. Has to do with landlord and tenant remedies for abuse of access. We think here is a change to provide that lawful denial of lawful access would mean that you're not giving the tenant access or giving the landlord access within a 24-hour period, assuming there hasn't been a 30-day notice to quit, as we've suggested, or an emergency. Think that if there's been the 24-hour given request and not given this to be an unlawful access, and the other right to go in and terminate the rental agreements. So we're just merely setting out a specific time for defining what would be lawful or unlawful access. We suggest the 24-hour period that's already been drafted and built. That's all I'm saying.
Any further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jim Clark.
Chairman, my name is James Clark. I'm a member of the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws, which was responsible for drafting original SB 159. What you have before you is a substantially modified Senate revision of the Uniform Act. However, I wish to appear here today to say that, speaking as a commissioner, but not for the commission, that this is a bill that we hope you will give favorable consideration. I would like to file at this time, for purposes of saving time, some copies of a statement made to the California Senate Committee on the Judiciary by Professor Julian Levy of the University of Chicago, who was the reporter for the Uniform Act, describing as his history and his progress through the conference. The need for landlord-tenant reform is primarily a product of history and legislative inaction. The present law of landlord and tenant developed in the 17th century before there was a law of contract in an agricultural society in which all that the tenant got was possession. This meant that there were no obligations on either side of the relationship except to give and secure possession. In the 19th century, with the rise of urban housing, a contract relationship developed, which did not, however, modify the common law property concept. The result was that the tenant had, in modern times, substantially fewer rights than you or I had if we make a contract, say, to buy an automobile. There's no obligation to repair, to maintain fit premises. The doctrine of independent covenants still prevails. There is no defense to an action for eviction for non-payment of rent. That case went up from Oregon to the United States Supreme Court less than 2 years ago in Lindsay against Norman, and was held that there was no constitutional right to a defense for non-payment of rent based upon the condition of the premises. In short, these two strands of historical development combine to overweight the landlord-tenant relationship in favor of landlords, at least as judged, we think, by modern urban conditions. With the rapidly increasing number of citizens who are in a tenant relationship as distinguished from a homeownership relationship, it has become a matter of urgent social concern that this relationship be examined by the legislature. Now, there are two broad characteristics of the Uniform Act which I think are still in SB 159 as it has come from the Senate. The first, the commissioners were not trying to play cops and robbers. There were no white hats and black hats in our considerations. What we were trying to do was to identify the essential relationship interests of the two sides to this problem. The landlord's interest is an economic interest primarily. The tenant's interest, which is becoming more important under modern conditions, is that the tenancy, the apartment, is his home. And it is this aspect of the relationship which the common law has ignored. What we have tried to produce is a balanced piece of legislation which will preserve the essential interests of both parties. Now, I'd like to speak just parenthetically about Section 21. I'm not unusually happy with the exact language, but I want to tell you what the objective is and why we're trying to do it. In some states, they have rent withholding statutes. If the premises are not up to code or up to standard, the tenants can withhold the rent. We had pressed upon us very hard by tenant groups in the drafting process rent abatement provisions, in which case, if the premises were not up to standard, there would have been no obligation to pay rent ever. Now this, of course, is an alarming proposal, and it should be an alarming proposal, to a landlord who has mortgage payments to make, to a finance company which has loaned money to the landlord, to an insurance company which has financed development. In other words, the cash flow which the property is supposed to produce is very important. It is, we think, also important that a tenant should have some relief in a situation where the premises are substandard. If you are in a contractual relationship and the other side breaches the contract, in many cases, you don't have to perform, or you can withhold performance without terminating the contract. A tenant does not have that contract right under present law. So it was the purpose of Section 21 to provide a remedy by which the tenant would not be allowed to stay in the premises rent-free. But the landlord, on the other hand, would have an incentive to keep the premises up to standard so that his cash flow will be maintained. The second broad characteristic of this Uniform Act proposal, which I'd like to refer to, is, I think, to some extent responsive to what's been said before. This act is designed to be a skeleton, not a Bible. I think it has been the course of the law, at least the good statutes, that you do not try to spell out every single contingency and define every term as if you were constructing a building code. Courts deal every day with general concepts such as negligence, willfulness, materiality. These are the day-to-day substance of what judges and lawyers do. And it was our conclusion, and it was a conscious policy conclusion on the part of the Congress, that if you attempt to do what they've done in some eastern states, which is to spell out in great detail what the landlord's obligations are to the tenant, it leads to wholesale evasion, and it tends to break down by having an unwieldy number of small lawsuits in the courts. This, probably the most important provisions of this act, are the obligation of good faith and the concept of unconscionability. Every aspect of the landlord-tenant relationship under this bill is subject to the obligation of good faith. Now that is a concept which has been imported into this act from the Uniform Commercial Code, and it has worked well there. There are a number of provisions in the act which I think you should give careful consideration to. Some of them have been mentioned. I would like to refer to the section on prohibited provisions, which is Section 9. As Senator Burns pointed out, it was felt that there is a problem with respect to the continued use of form contracts, bedsheet contracts, in some cases, in which there are provisions which are prohibited by law. And the fact that they are in the contract or the rental agreement tends to make them self-enforcing, because in many cases tenants do not see lawyers. We don't want them to have to see lawyers. And it is in our view, it was important this was a particular abuse which ought to be treated specifically. So we have a prohibition against putting these clauses in rental agreements. The act was 3 years in the writing. It was considered by an advisory committee to the National Conference, on which we represented every interest we could get before us to help us. It's now been considered by the Senate, and we very much hope that the present bill will receive your favorable consideration. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Any questions? Representative Burroughs.
Can you be responding to what you be offering comments or answering questions regarding the other two bills?
I would prefer not to. My understanding of the general situation, and I'm sure that there are people who are more closely advised about those bills than I am, is that our bill is in the middle so far as the general direction of the thrust of the statute is concerned. Our bill was not, well, we started with very few preconceived ideas of where we wanted to go. If SB 159 looks like a tenant-oriented bill, I can assure you that substantial parts of what the tenants wanted and were willing to fight for were not in it when it came out of the conference, and they certainly aren't in it now. I wish to associate myself with Senator Burns' remarks. I think it would be unfortunate if this bill were weakened any further. Thank you.
Thank you. In sort of a rhetorical answer to your question, Representative Burroughs, staff has been instructed to prepare a comparison of the three bills for us, and so that we may evaluate their provisions on our own and have an opportunity to be even more prepared for the second hearing. Owing to the lateness of the session, Senate Bill 159, I think, has to be the vehicle for accomplishing what we want, if anything, to happen in this field. And so I've scheduled the hearings on these bills simultaneously so that we might have some input in that regard. In that regard, at this point, I'd like to skip over to House Bill 2542 and call on Bobby Gary.
My name is Bobby Gary, and I live at 2642 Southeast Tibbetts, Portland. And I am speaking on House Bill 2542. House Bill 2542 came from the state CPL. The bill was written by the Portland chapter of the state CPL. That's Citizens for Progress through Law. And I'm also speaking as a low-income person, a person who rents, a person who has dealt with the problem of landlords. And I know that House Bill 2542 has the kinds of provisions that we, the people who are affected by landlords, have an interest in our own welfare. And I speak to this bill and ask that you give consideration. There are some portions. I am not speaking against 159. We concur with some of the things in 159, but there are sections, particularly the section about repair reductions. And this is not in there, and we do have this in 2542. In comparison of the two bills, I'd like to see the good things in 159 amended to 2542. There are sections in there that if you will make the comparison in that one in particular, that are very, very important to low-income people and people who suffer from these terms of the landlord. And I think the bill is very fair to both landlord and tenant, and this has not been so before. And I'd like to have this consideration given to 2542. And I'd also like to have Mr. Blaine will give some of the sections I'm talking about.
Okay. Questions?
Are any questions?
Any questions on part of the committee?
I just have one.
Representative Whiting.
Just a softball question. If you were given the choice of having no bill or one bill that has a chance of getting through and becoming law, would you swing with SB 159?
Very definitely. Very definitely. With the amendments from 2542 given consideration.
Thank you. Dan Wolf.
My name is Daniel H. Wolf. I reside in 1904 Southwest Market Street Drive in Portland. I represent Citizens of Oregon for Decent Housing, which is a small but dedicated group of tenants and a couple of landlords, which is committed to better housing and better landlord-tenant relations in the state of Oregon. During late 1971 and early 1972, we drafted and circulated a ballot initiative petition, which tried to put several landlord-tenant measures on the ballot in the general election. We got a late start, and we didn't get on the ballot, but about 10,000 Oregon citizens did sign the petition to get it on the ballot. There were at least that many in the state interested, as you can see. If we had placed our measure on the ballot, it would have accomplished some of the following. Number one, establish an implied warranty of habitability in leased dwellings in Oregon. This is included in SB 159. Number two, establish repair and deduct rent withholding law in Oregon, which was in SB 159 and is not now. Number three, abolish landlord's lien. Number four, guarantee the return of security deposits. Number five, establish retaliatory defenses against retaliatory evictions. Number six, it would have allowed equitable defenses to be asserted in eviction actions, the above mentioned FED proceedings. Number seven, it would have prevented tenants from being summarily locked out of their dwellings without hearings or notice. In addition to the petition drive, which we did, we also operated the landlord tenant information referral service. This may have been one of the few in the nation. You've got my copy. We took about 500 calls in the course of the actual operation of this information referral service. We still take calls on an informal basis, and I still talk to several people a week in my home. Oh, thank you, man. That's the wrong one. The vast majority of problems which people called about regarded needed repairs that landlords refused to make, calls on evictions and security deposits. There was also landlord harassment, lockouts, etc. Because of the state of the existing law in Oregon, there was little we could advise tenants to do. People generally expressed shock, indignation, disappointment that tenants had so few rights. They still express these emotions. We did refer people to legal aid and private attorneys when their incomes exceeded legal aid guidelines. There seems to be little that attorneys can do to resolve tenant-landlord disputes under present law, except to say, landlord wins. Citizens of Oregon Decent Housing endorses SB 159 and urges this committee to give it a due pass recommendation, even as is. We do not want to see it weakened. We feel it has gone as far as it can go and still have our support. We believe this bill will do much to solve the problems of tenants that we have talked to over the past year. And remember, we've talked to thousands of tenants. In spite of the protests of landlords, from our experience, we find that most landlords are decent, honest landlords who consider good landlord-tenant relations part of good business relations. We find that they would usually are already in compliance with what SB 159 would require. If any criticism can be leveled at SB 159, it is that it fails to protect the tenant enough. We feel that Oregon law should provide that no tenant can be evicted from his dwelling without just cause. When people are uprooted from their homes, they should get more than a mere 30-day notice. A landlord should have to have a good reason, not just prejudice, not just off the top of his head for some reason. He should have a good reason for making a family move. Further, the bill fails to allow a judge in a forcible entry and detainer action the discretion to allow the family to remain in the dwelling for an added length of time if moving immediately would cause them a hardship. Massachusetts and other states allow judges such discretion, up to 6 months in some cases. The Act has no receivership provision, which would allow cities or counties to take over substandard buildings and repair them with rent collected from tenants. Other states allow local governmental units to do this, notably Illinois and Chicago. I might add that the repair periods called for in SB 159, I noticed there's some dispute about that, are not too short. I work with a construction outfit. I'm an architectural designer, and my experience with this outfit and also with my past experience with Citizens of Oregon Producing Housing indicates that those periods are plenty long. Our relationships with subcontractors and with maintenance people working generally tend to make those periods more than ample if we would if the landlord only gets on the stick. Parts of House Bill 2424 and SB 159. I would hate to see many more parts of 2424 placed in SB 159. One section 14 is derived from the Civil Code of California. If that was in our ballot initiative, I feel that's one of the few parts of 2424 that is good. I do not want to see it weakened. That's it.
Senator Morris?
Two questions, if I may. Section 12 of the security deposit.
Mm-hmm.
It points out two things that can be used for. One is rent default payment. Two is repair damage. We've heard testimony about cleaning deposit. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, I'm all in favor of returning security deposits and cleaning deposits. I think that generally landlords have been deficient in trying to protect their profits from legitimate business expenses such as cleaning after a tenant move. In the case of normal
you don't
wear
support
and tear.
Cleaning deposits, then?
No, I come again.
You don't support a cleaning deposit?
No, I don't have no disagreement with cleaning deposits for willful damage. But I think normal wear and tear, you know, is the kind of thing that's a legitimate business expense. I think in too many cases, and I've spoken with landlords about this, landlords will generally use the security deposit. They place a security deposit on the top of the rent because they consider it extra income. And I think this is, you know, this is an occurrence that's developed to an alarming degree. You know, the security deposits get up to $100 or more depending on, you know, the income range. I think that wear and tear should come out of profits that landlords made in the past.
One other question. You made a comment that is an interesting one. Landlords should not be allowed to release a tenant unless it's a good cause, terminate a relationship, unless there's a good cause. Do you base that kind of a statement and a philosophy on your own personal experience or on the study that you've made?
Well, I can't base anything I say or feel on just one particular thing. I base it on everything I know.
Have you had personal experience?
I have never been evicted. You know, I have the good fortune to place myself in general good landlord. But I do believe that I've run into too darn many tenants who have been evicted just simply because the landlord doesn't like the color of his hair, you know, or some ridiculous thing. There are innumerable incidents of young people, of course, being evicted because of cohabitation, or, for instance, they don't like the color of their skin.
Do you agree or disagree with that?
Well, I think cohabitation is not illegal in the state of Oregon, so I disagree with the eviction on that standard.
Thank you.
But that's totally a limit.
Further questions? Wanda Merrill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Wanda Merrill, Administrator of the Consumer Services Division. I don't want to take your time today to go through a list that I have of landlord-tenant complaints. We feel that Senate Bill 159 has amended. As Mr. Wolf said, it has section
lockout reported to us, and I realize that that's against the law in Oregon, and they can go and see an attorney, but as it's always been stated today, that isn't always the answer. I would like to say that not all the complaints that we have received, the landlord-tenant complaints, were valid. And we do investigate them all, and we do attempt to seek some kind of arbitration between the two if we can. With no landlord-tenant law in Oregon, however, the tenant is always faced with just being told that he can move out. And the landlords are quick to say that if you don't like the water situation, or you don't like the bath situation, or there's not enough heat, you can move. And this is a very easy thing to say. And I certainly think they have the investment, and they have a right to the property. On the other hand, it's not inexpensive to move, as all of us know. Not only do you have the moving costs themselves, but you also have the fact that your curtains don't fit the windows, and your furniture may not fit, and your kids may not like going to the other school, and you have other problems in that area. I hope that Senate Bill 159 will receive your consideration.
I just have a couple of questions. One, do you keep a sort of a file on each complaint, so that cross checks can be run as to whether or not a similar complaint has been logged in the past? Or
well, we keep quite extensive files, and we're not as extensively as we hope to do after July, when we will have another person to poke in our office. But we do have them filed, so we can pull all of the files for anyone that wishes to see them. We have written complaints on them, and we have names and addresses, so we can refer them
to. I would be very curious to see how many of these are repeat offenses.
Uptight, you mean, sir?
Yeah, repeat offenses of either, well, primarily the same landlord being involved.
There are not too many that are. Those that are usually in the big complexes where you have, say, 500 or 600 rentals in one company. And as I said, not all of those are valid. For instance, we had a mother come in very irate because her daughter had been receiving a bill for $200 in damages after she and three friends moved out of the apartment. On the face of it, of course, looking at it from her side, it appeared to be a very valid complaint, and the young people were being taken. And when we looked into it on the landlord's side, we discovered that there was a good deal of damage done to the apartment and to the furniture and to some other things.
How far back do your records go?
Our office was started in October of 71.
Have the complaints been consistently on the increase?
Yes, they have. In the last maybe 6 months or so, they have run, as I said, around 20 a month.
About 20 a month.
And these are complaints. These are not inquiries. We receive a lot of inquiries about can the landlord do this or can he do that, which we do not file as an official complaint unless he asks.
I wonder if your office or maybe someone later can provide us with some information as to maybe the trend. It seems to me if we're heading in the direction of more multifamily dwellings and more situations like this, that this problem may be even more acute in the years ahead.
The type of rentals that might be coming up, sir?
Mm-hmm.
I'm afraid we don't have that.
Maybe housing division would be able to get us that information. On a similar sort of a front, if indeed it's becoming that houses are going to be harder and harder to get into, are going to be more and more expensive, are we going to be running into more of these problems, I guess, is what I'm sort of wondering. Anyway, we can have someone look at that. Any questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Call Mr. Paul Wang.
My name is Paul Wang. I live 11 Payne, Southeast of Baltimore Street, Portland. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I just want to mention some very important points. Provided by Horst the unit owned or operated by the public holding authority. So because that would be good for the low-income people, because most of the tenants living in the public holding unit is low-income people. That's the page 5, subsection 9, tenant definition. Specifically mentioned, so this law would apply to the holding unit operated by holding authority. The second important point is the repair deduction. So just mentioned, originally there is the same provision in the Senate Bill 109, that's later on the amended and deleted. So I would like to see this repair deduction, so we'll keep it as to the beer. That's the page 8. Deduction repair, section 20. Page 8, section 20. The third point is on page 10. That's the section 23. That's the tenant's remedy in general. So this is a very important provision. That means that if the tenant give the written notice to the landlord, request the landlord to repair something, but after a certain period of time, so the landlord didn't take any action, so the tenant can refuse to pay the rent to the landlord. But the tenant has wanted to keep the rent himself, he should deposit the rent to the county auditor. Let the county auditor hold the rent. After 3 months, if the landlord still take no action, so the tenant would pay the rent every month to the county auditor. After 3 months, the landlord still take no action, so the tenant will apply for returning the funds, and then terminate the agreement, and then leave the unit. That's a very important provision for the tenant. Number four, that's on page 16, section 35, security deposit. So there's a provision here that the security deposit should be deposited to a escrow bank, hold by an escrow bank, neither by the landlord nor by the tenants, by third party. That means more secure, either for the landlord or for the tenants. So there's no provision in 159 or 1044. Number 5, on page 17, so the section 36, the sublease and assignments, there's specifically mentioned regarding the racial discrimination and also the welfare recipient. That means the landlord couldn't refuse to rent the unit to the welfare recipient or on the basis of racial or religion or national origin and so on and so forth. So that's specifically provided here in this bill. Number 6, that's on page 22. That's the summary proceeding for possession. So that's the specific provision in this beer. That's nothing in other two beers. Number 7, the page 27, that's section 56, action for waste. That means except the remedy in general for the tenants, here there's another provision to protect the tenant's right. That means if the tenant found somewhere would be hazardous dust to the hairs, and then the tenants apply to the landlord for repair, for for, you know, change that situation. If the landlord didn't take any action, so the tenants can take action to do that job. So except for the repair deduction, here that's provision. That means if the tenant start with the job, the landlord is put up there for a injunction from the court. Even restrict the judge couldn't issue injunction in this case. If the tenant start to do some repair work, the landlord didn't do that. So there's provision here. Number 8 on page 28, that's attorney fees. So here, that means no provision, no attorney fees should be provided in the rate of agreement. That would be fair for both parties, either the landlord or tenants. And no one could put this provision in the rate of agreement, that's such as which one should pay the attorney fees. That's the provision for both sides. That's a fair for both sides. Number 9, on the same page 28, the section 61, that means the landlord couldn't refuse rent the unit to the family because the family is a children. I spent with so many children. So that's provision here, but no same provision in 159 or 2424. The last one, number 10, on page 29, section 62, that the landlord should provide a summary of this act to the tenants at the beginning when the tenants are float landlords for rental units. In that case, that means you impose duty to the landlord. Then the landlord must tell the tenants there is such a law governing the landlord and tenant relations. Because most of the tenants, especially low-income tenants, such as not as educated as the landlord. Now maybe that's probably not true, but I just know I just say it's generally. So maybe the most of the tenants doesn't know even this. Acting that this law be passed through this stage. Maybe so many tenants don't know that. So that's why we put in clause here, put in provision here, impose duty, you know, on the landlord. The landlord should tell the tenant that there's such a law. If the tenant want a copy, the landlord should supply a copy, but at the tenant's own expense. So in conclusion, I would like to see the committee based on the cost period 2542 and take all the good parts from Senate Bill 159, combine these two bills together, let it be most comprehensive and the most balanced bill to cover the national trade relations. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you very much. Charlie Williamson.
We have a lot of material. I hope it will alarm and save the committee time. Chastised for passing in a lot of material by the landlords in the Senate, so I thought I'd get file folders that might help keep things in order. There's a list of what's in here. I'd just like to briefly just show you what's in there and run through it so you understand what's there without reading it. There's a list of the groups that have supported Senate Bill 159. There's about 4 newspaper articles and editorials in the Oregon Journal supporting Senate Bill 159. Actually, some of these were before it was amended to its present form. They supported it even in its stronger form. The next item is a 3-page document entitled National Conference Commission on Uniform State Laws. tenants' remedies, the economic significance. This is a little summary that was put together by the conference office in Chicago that deals with the landlord's argument that this act will be of economic significance to them. There's only two studies in the country, but both involve tenant rights bills substantially more tenant-oriented than this bill. And the studies related in this three-page essay indicate that there was really no substantial economic impact in Detroit or Philadelphia after more stringent tenants' rights measures were adopted in Michigan and Philadelphia. The next is a statement. The next item in the folder is a statement by Ms. Cheryl Daly, who was a tenant who was victimized last summer by a landlord turning off her essential services when she was current in her rent and trying to force all the tenants in the building to move out. The next statement is a statement of Mayo Shiga, who is a Multnomah County Health Bureau inspector. He indicates that this bill would be, and this was when the repairing duct was still in the bill, would be of significant effect in assisting the city of Portland in, for him, speaking for himself, in enforcing habitable housing and sanitary conditions in Portland. I'll just quickly run over these, you can read them at length later. Mary Lee Lesser, it's a statement from her, a brief statement indicating the problem she had. She wasn't even a tenant, but she left some of her stuff in a tenant's house and the landlord confiscated it. For 2 years, she still hasn't gotten it back. That was because of the landlord's lien. Another piece of testimony by Patricia Knight is a current case where she had a landlord's lien executed against her belongings when the landlord illegally increased the rent in violation of phase two rent control. She was willing to pay the rent, but they wouldn't accept a lesser amount. They wanted the full amount and took her everything in her apartment, basically. Next is a statement by Helen Bailey, a landlord, saying that she thinks she could adequately protect herself if this bill is passed, and it's really sloppy or unethical landlords would be affected. Statement by Audrey Shervey, next in the file, indicates a problem she had with security deposits. Now, most of these people would be willing to come down. I thought that if we presented these in writing to you, it would save time. Some of them did come down for the Senate hearings and didn't get a chance to testify because of the number of people involved. The last two items in the file are, first, there's a summary of Senate Bill 159, House Bill 2424, and House Bill 2542. This is based on a summary that I believe was done by Representative Akinson's office. I've updated that summary to take into account the amendments to 159, and I've also added a couple of sections. I hope that might be of help to your staff preparing their comparison. And lastly is a section-by-section analysis of Senate Bill 159, which I will really just leave with you to read at your leisure. I think it's too lengthy to go over here. I would like to just make some brief points about this bill, about Senate Bill 159. First of all, reform in this area is absolutely essential. I think the prior witnesses have made that point. Senate Bill 159 has been really drastically amended from when it was first introduced. Tenants did not get what they wanted in the Uniform Act. Tenant groups in Oregon compromised, they felt anyway, in backing the Uniform Act. Then the Uniform Act has been, they've taken the following things out of Senate Bill 159 and said they deleted the repair and deduct section. They deleted the section that would have required landlords to comply with local codes and spelled out the minimum things in section 14. I was really surprised with all the comment on section 12 on security deposits. The language in that section was worked out by Mr. Church, Mr. Bernie, myself, and section on the Senate Bill 159. I'm really surprised that there's been any question that it's objectionable. We're not really wedded to any of the language in the bill, but I really hate to see the bill amended for no reason either, and having to go back to the Senate. Fourth, in amending the security deposit provision, they deleted the portion of the Uniform Act that would have placed a one month's rent maximum on deposits. They reduced the landlord's damages for wrongfully withholding deposit, and they clearly spelled out, I thought, what more clearly than the Uniform Act, spelled out what the deposit was to be used for. And the answer to, I believe, Representative Morris's question about fees, if somebody wants to charge a cleaning fee, that's not covered by this section. If you say this is a $25 non-refundable fee, it's just like part of the rent, it's charged. But the real problem you have is tenants that spend a weekend cleaning up a place, and then go to get back the deposit, and the landlord just says, well, you don't get it back. If the tenant knows they're not going to have to get it back, they can act accordingly. This way, they're, in essence, cheated into working to clean up a place. Yes?
Then maybe there should be some clarification about it.
Well, I thought it was clear that where defined deposit is a deposit, and a fee is a fee. This is simply a term of deposit.
Can I ask one other question on this bill that bothers me? In section 32.
Yes, sir.
Subparagraph 2. And this is retaliatory conduct prohibited. And there's a statement in there, in an action by or against the tenant, evidence of a complaint within 6 months before the alleged act of retaliation creates a disputable presumption that the landlord's conduct was in retaliation. That 6 months provision, I submit, is totally unreasonable. It's too long a period of time. What are your comments?
Well, it was 1 year in the Uniform Act, and the Senate shortened that to 6 months. As a practical matter, the tenant is in a position of trying to prove what the landlord's intent is. There's no way he can do that if they're on equal footing. Really, basically, no way, unless he said something that indicates what his intent is. But if he simply sends a notice, there's no way the tenant can. If he doesn't have a retaliatory motive, he can come into court and overcome it. A disputable presumption is defined in order to law, simply a presumption is valid until evidence is presented which rebuts it. And so it simply places a burden of proof on the person that has the evidence which can show what his intent is. Now, the landlord comes in within that 6 months and says, I want the place back because my mother-in-law is moving out here, or I need it for myself because I'm moving in there, or I need to renovate it. If he comes in and just gives the court, or really just gives the tenant a reasonable explanation, I doubt if tenants are really going to fight about it, especially if they're going to be subject to landlord's attorney's fees if they lose the case. And secondly, all they have to do is explain it to the court should a tenant really want to fight it.
Just let me ask one other question, Mr. Chairman. You made a statement that intrigued me, and that is you would not like, in your judgment, to see this committee make substantial changes or changes to this bill for fear of what would happen for concurrence within the Senate. You obviously followed this bill through the Senate. You know the motions that were there for this bill. This, we have one other committee in the House that received or had this kind of thought put into on the Senate bill. Do you feel in your judgment that amendments other than minor, any substantial amendments would seriously damage this bill in Senate concurrence?
Even if you made the bill, yeah, I think if you made it stronger, that would, for example, we love having repairing the dock. It's a very important section. It's worked well in other states where it's existed. We're really sorry. I think it was probably necessary.
Well, if we were to put in things like clarification on the cleaning deposit, if we went to section 21 and tried to clarify it a little more, if we went to section 32 and changed the 6 months to 90 days, for example, do you think these kinds of actions, in your judgment, would damage the chances of this bill back in
the I couldn't ask the committee to pass on something that they think was right because...
Well, I realize that. I'm just asking for your own opinion.
No, I think the Senate would concur.
Okay.
common law right on the landlord to disarray and keep hold tenant's property from a tenant, even if he doesn't have a landlord's lien? There's a statutory landlord's lien that spells out specifically what a landlord has to do to get a lien to take the property to sell it. He has to post a copy of the statute. He has to wait 90 days before he sells it.
Disarray just means hold.
Right. Supreme Court of Oregon held that, well, I think maybe he can disclose it as well. I'm not certain exactly what's included in that common law right. But he can hold it. We've had landlords that have held that spot for years under this act. The Supreme Court of Oregon has held that the landlord's lien statute, even though it was enacted to specifically, apparently set down specific things a landlord had to do to get a lien, he still didn't have to follow that. He could just disclaim the property.
The second question is also a legal term, disputable presumption. When is the dispute?
Well, there's various types of presumptions. There's a conclusive presumption. If a child is born of a husband and wife or wedlock, then he's conclusively presumed to be that child. And you cannot, no matter what, introduce evidence. Maybe you can't have it. Generally, you haven't been able to introduce any evidence to show that that's not your child. A disputable presumption is something that just establishes a burden of proof and it can be overcome. But a landlord is disputably presumed to be acting in a retaliatory manner if he tries to evict a tenant within 6 months after he complained to the local code authorities. A landlord can overcome that disputable presumption simply by coming in and showing the real reason for the eviction. The landlord is the only person that has that information.
The burden of proof that is upon whom that a disputable presumption.
The person against whom the presumption operates. So the disputable presumption places the burden of proof on the landlord, in this case, to show why he was evicting the tenant. For the first 6 months, after 6 months, the burden of proof is back on the tenant to show that the landlord was acting in a retaliatory way. Keith Burns, I think, explained the problem with attorney's fees. This, while the Senate felt this was good, it really, placing landlords and tenants on equal footing as far as attorney's fees go, really does give the landlord a significant advantage. They're in a much better position to be able to afford attorney's fees.
What section is that?
I think it's out of 11.
Representative Martin.
In view of the recent declaration by a member of the Senate about that holding, do you have any comment about reasonable attorney's fees?
Well, there were two basic amendments that were presented to the Senate. One was to outlaw attorney's fees altogether. Say everybody pays their own attorney no matter who wins and who loses, unless there's malicious or willful misconduct. And the second was what was adopted here. I think as far as tenants go, they would rather not have to pay because of the possibility of having to pay a landlord's attorney if they lost. They would rather just have, you know, pay their own attorney and not have to worry about double attorney's fees. This section 27, lastly, was a measure that was introduced into Chapter 159, which allows abandoned tenant property to be disposed of by landlords. And again, I was surprised to hear criticism of that section when it was taken basically out of House Bill 2424, which is a landlord's tenant bill. I'm sorry I've gone so long, Mr. Chairman. I think that's the crux of what I have to say. If that answers any more questions.
Further questions?
Can I just ask a question? It's an off-beat question, Charlie. There's no way that mobile home establishments are covered in this in any way.
Not to my knowledge. There was Representative Grinnell who introduced an amendment in the Senate that would have covered them. It may well be that they should be covered. It's sort of hard to, if you're just renting a plot of ground on which somebody's supposed to put their own mobile home, it's sort of hard to cover that with all the other, you know, providing the weatherproofing and so forth. It doesn't quite fit. We have had, there's a case now in Clackamas County, I know of, I guess Representative Grinnell had another one on the coast, where resident of Trailer Park complained to local authorities about housing, about the violations of code conditions. Well, there was actually, I guess it's a place in Clackamas County where the water isn't good, or it's, the pressure is not the code, and they're still bringing in more and more people in violation of the code. And one resident complained about it, and they're being evicted, and there's no sort of, they're not eligible for legal aid, they're wealthy people, and they're just appalled, and there's nothing they can do about it. I think the ACLU is helping.
Along the same thought, what about people who rent mobile homes out?
They would be covered, because they're renting a dwelling unit.
Further questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
I might say at this point, I intend to go about 10 more minutes. We will have another hearing on this bill Friday in this room, I hope, if we can get it. But the chances are of getting the room, but we are willing to take up this bill again on Friday, 1/2 hour after the session adjourns, or 1 p.m., whichever is earlier. Sir?
Sir, I signed up. I'm either for the bill or against. I've been in property management for several years. I've done a lot of research. I have Dan Wolf in my house. I have Charlie Williams on behalf of the Portland County and the Oregon Department Association. I think I can tell you folks, your position is to evaluate these bills. I think I can say a few things. Neither for or against, I would help you folks. Is it possible to take the chair out of regular order?
Can you be here Friday?
I'm not positive I can, sir. I'm supposed to be in Canada.
Well, a number of people who are, I'm sure everyone is an expert on the bill.
I'm not saying I'm an expert on the bill. I told you that that's not my purpose. I'm a maintenance man, I'm a country boy, but I can answer your question.
What's the committee's pleasure? If there's any worry that this committee is going to act on this bill quickly, I mean, that's not, it's not a worry.
I'll say my position is to evaluate a problem, you've got to know what it is.
I can appreciate
and
that.
And therefore,
well,
today, you see, well, this is what I want to tell you. There's no sense in saying it here. I can let you know how to evaluate your problem succinctly, with good evaluation, both on Charlie's side and on Dan's and the others.
I know. This legislature has allocated a good deal of money for staff for research too, and I can appreciate.
Okay, sir. I'm sorry, I spoke out of turn.
If the committee would like to go out of the order, I'd be happy to consider it. What's the committee's feeling? Go ahead.
Sir, like I mentioned, neither for or against. I heard James Clark when he was in Portland, when he talked about his uniform code. Like I mentioned, I've had Charlie Wilson in my home. We've talked about problems and solutions, both sides. When we talk about security deposit, let's think about the human problem. We all have, yes?
Could you identify yourself?
Yes, Irwin Abel from Portland, Oregon. Phone number 232-7976. Address 1816 Southeast 24. From the side of a landlord, when you rent an apartment, you're renting to the 5 senses an individual has. The smell, hearing, touch, sight,
5A and based. Okay, there's some things you can't identify, and that's a living organism that's in a carpet, and it causes smell. It can be perfectly clean, but it can smell atrocious. There's no way money's going to cover a carpet. When it comes to feel, if the person has walked off of the parking lot and he has oil because of coming off the parking lot into a shag carpet, he can ruin it if it comes in with his feet. Things that you can't identify until time takes over. The larva of bugs, when it hatches, sometimes 60 days. The problem is not with the code, it's not with the law. It's with things that we can't see, taste, or feel that come to life. It's a different weight on both sides. I'm all for, and I think that Charlie and Dan and the rest have got a good foundation. But the point being that injustice and the living organism in carpets, especially in the new apartments where they demand that kind of textured living, walls that are painted with a flat wall paint, that smudges as soon as you touch it. The demands of society are saying we demand more security deposit. Their living habits, everybody's got a pet. Everybody's got to feed the pet. If the pet urinates in a closet and the urine goes down through the carpet, into the pad, into the chipboard, there's no way to get the smell out unless you take up the floor. The urine will penetrate, it being an alkali, right down into your chipboard. That's not cleanable. It means pulling the carpet out and starting over. The apartment can be totally clean. And so what does the landlord do? He takes umbrage. He wants to fight back there. He doesn't know what the problem is. All he knows is it's going to cost him money. The tenant leaves, says it's clean, it's okay, I want my security deposit back. I have just written a little letter here for you folks. I think that probably, and I'm sorry I said well again to you, Mr. Chairman, was the fact that I don't think we know the problem. We've hashed around these bills trying to straighten them out for a long period of time. It's deeper than you and I know. It goes further than that. I think that we ought to take time to really get sophisticated. Today, Oregon is following what other states have done, and the other states don't know. We know that vocationally property management and the management in apartments is probably the least sophisticated vocation there is today. It is becoming sophisticated. People are starting to take a moral response to life. They're starting to take a mechanical way of saying, okay, we can solve these problems, and I think that that's where we need to go. I recommend more time to negotiate the bills that presented. There is a need for an education poster to be posted in all residential rental property for the instruction of tenants and what action they might take against the landlord. They got to know that. There are steps today, the health department, the fire department, and all of the rest. I was sued by Legal Aid Friday. I did not take a stand on this because I felt that it was not worth taking a stand because they would work out their own problems if they could only figure them out and give them enough time. I'm saying at this particular point, time has run out and they haven't figured out their own problems. I got sued by a man that threw garbage through our hole, down through the crawl hole, down underneath the apartment, put two holes in the wall like this. Had a large dog that was against the rules and regulations, and I have pictures of the apartment here. I'll just distribute to you. It makes no difference, except we do not know the answer. Give it time. Don't put through something today that's going to hurt individuals. If you want to know the ins and outs of property management and also the tenant, get Dan Wolf and these people together with some sophisticated property managers and iron out your problems. Today, we don't have the answers, the 159 or the others. It's just not there. We've created welfare states and many, many states along with New York and all of the rest and the apartment business. It's wrong. I think there's a better, more sophisticated way. And that's what I'm trying to say. There's answers there and they can be answered, but they're going to come from the little guy that does the maintenance. The guy that has to rip up the chipboard. The guy that has to go in and deflee the place. The one that has to go out and put sprays under the apartment because of bugs and cockroaches and all the rest. They're the ones that can tell you why it costs money. Not the landlord, nor the lawyer. Let's get to the base of the problem.
Representative Martin.
Chairman. In your opinion, we shouldn't pass anything?
I stated in this that I think that there are several things we ought to do. I think that we should pass. I have talked to them about it several times.
the need for uniform standard forms. A security agreement that the landlord knows is going to protect him and that the tenant knows they're going to protect him. Not one by every different property owner. It should be like the real estate, they have an earnest money agreement. We ought to have something standard that they become, the tenant becomes educated to, and the landlord becomes educated to. A month-to-month tenancy agreement that is simple, succinct, and that the law backs up. We don't. We're starting with the legal process without a form to follow. We need to create the form first. We need to say, okay, in every cupboard of every apartment, there should be a form that says these steps, if your landlord is neglecting, you should take. Phone the fire marshal, phone the health department. We have today legal agencies that can go out and talk to the construction company and turn them down and say, you haven't met code. We can cut out construction completely, but we can't say that because of a lack of education in the apartment industry. There are adequate laws today to fulfill the obligations of both tenant and landlord if we knew what they were and they were spelled out and we could follow them.
Any further questions? Thank you. One more, Emily Hsu, and then to the rest of you, I would hope that you could make it to the Friday hearing. What I'm trying to do is twofold, trying to get going on Senate bills and at the same time act on the some 80 bills, House bills that we've got besides this one in this committee. So we have to extend our normal working hours from 3 to 5 to Monday, Wednesday, and Friday of this week to try and do that at the same time. If you can just appreciate that this committee is laboring under more gross weight of bills than any other committee in the House, and we in turn are sorry that we can't take care of things in one hearing, but we do hope that you will either, if you can't make it back on Friday, send us some kind of a written statement or do join us on Friday. Go ahead.
I'm Emily Hsu, representing the League of Women Voters of Oregon, and I'm here to urge your support of SB 159. And I followed it as a representative of the League through the Senate hearing and agree with Charlie Williamson that this is a compromise and it's been thoroughly worked over and that it's something that's needed as a piece of legislation. The League has been studying housing in Oregon for about 5 years under what we call human resources. And our agreed that of the need to provide equal access for all citizens to comfortable and decent housing. And we too have heard the complaints, talked to the legal aid people about the number of tenant complaints over landlord-tenant relationships. We're also aware along with one now that not all of these probably are valid complaints, but many of them are. We also have learned that landlords have their side of the story too. And this bill is not intended to punish or to cause hardship to landlords. There's much to be said for having the rules written down on both sides. Going to court is a tedious process for landlords as well as tenants. And a code of action that is clearly understood on both sides is a benefit to both sides. We also hope that this bill would improve the quality of management. We've been particularly interested in low and moderate income housing and are aware of some of the problems involved in housing this income group. And it's pretty clear that the quality of the management has a lot to do with the success of the project. The budget is very tight, full occupancy is necessary. A few ornery tenants who move out can make or break a project. And what we need are some rules to see that that sort of thing doesn't happen. A clear statement of the rights and obligations of both parties to the rental agreement, along with procedures for dealing with the problems that may arise, will be of considerable assistance to both landlords and tenants.